Voilà, c'est bon. So the practice of shamatha is basically designed to help us establish a baseline of exceptional sanity. It's really nothing more than that. Just being really sound, being of sound mind, not losing our mind every, 10 seconds or so. And just as there are symptoms of having a mind that is ill, in a state of imbalance, Tsongkhapa is very clear on this point. And that is, insofar as, it's a gradient, it's not like, are you sane or are you not sane? There's a lot of area in between. Tsongkhapa is very clear on this, and that is, insofar as your mind is still dominated by mental afflictions, the usual suspects, then when you're sitting quietly, as we did for, 5 or 10 seconds there, it'll very rapidly become uncomfortable. You won't like it. It starts to feel bad. Agitated, restless, anxious, ill at ease. And you kind of want to start doing something. Anything. Anything. And a study was done, I think it was done last year. I've cited it a number of times. I'm going to cite it again. I think it was in America. A study was done of a group of men and women, and they were put in a room, you remember, for 15 minutes with nothing to do. Remember that one? At least a couple of you have not heard this story. Yeah, Danielle, I have not heard. Ready for a really good story? So these, normally people of sound mind, ordinary Americans, really fine people, ordinary American. What's all this sarcastic laughter? What, am I missing something? So this, these ladies and gentlemen, men and women, they were put in a room for 15 minutes, and there was nothing whatsoever to do in the room. They had a chair like yours, room temperature like this, not too hot, not too cold. Nobody's hungry, had good lunch just a few hours ago, so everything's fine, right? Just like that. They sat them in a chair with nothing to do for 15 minutes. Oh, there was one thing they could do if they so chose. They could give themselves an electric shock. But that was it, nothing else to do. And so you can either sit there quietly and just mind your own business, or you can go like that. 2/3 of the men chose to shock themselves. One guy in 15 minutes did it 180 times. And if you think you women are much better, well, you're better, but not that much better. 25% of the women, they would rather be giving themselves unpleasant electric shocks than that was preferable than sitting and just being unnerved by their own minds. That's how we are doing. I don't think Americans are that different from Australians. You'd like to think so, but I don't think so. I think we're all in the same soup. Same soup. So to be able to simply be present. So Tsongkhapa said, insofar as your mind is still prone to, dominated by mental afflictions, you're going to find it really tough just to be quiet with no stimulation. Be uncomfortable. It's going to be dukkha. And it's going to be genuine dukkha. Right? I draw the distinction, as many of you well know, between genuine happiness and stimulus-driven happiness. Stimulus-driven, it arises only when there's a stimulus. Take away the stimulus, pleasure's gone, right? Genuine happiness doesn't need a stimulation. It's arising by itself. Not mystically, it's just a symptom of a balanced mind. It feels good. And a symptom of an imbalanced mind feels bad. And if you have an unpleasant stimulus, then it feels bad on top of bad. Then you have stimulus-driven displeasure. You have an unhappy thought, you smell something disgusting, you see something, you hear something, but something unpleasant happens to you, then you feel bad. Okay. That's hedonic displeasure or stimulus-driven displeasure. But the displeasure, the sense of ill at ease, the dukkha, the dissatisfaction, the feeling of ill at ease that arises when nothing's happening to you and not necessarily even any negative thoughts, which is another form of stimulation, that's genuine. That's the type of suffering that's interesting. The other ones, there are bound to be methods to make it go away. And the whole of modernity is just designed to help us with that. All the entertainments, the work, the things to do, People magazine is for very bored people. have nothing else to do, and so they read People magazine, you know. And I'm not picking on People, but there's just a lot of junk food for the mind out there. And that's for people that would just like to do anything to get their minds off their minds. So for dealing with hedonically, or let's say stimulus-driven displeasure, we don't need to look to Dharma. There's all kinds of help out there. And it's very marketable. You make a lot of money on this. You know? Whereas for experiencing a sense of well-being that comes when you're just being and when you're not doing, you can't sell that. You can't sell that. And you can't buy it. You can be the richest man on earth. You can be Bill Gates. You can be Carlos Slim. They don't have enough money. You can't buy it. There's no ticket price. You literally can't buy it. And if you try to find a drug that'll give it to you, that drug's going to wear off. It's stimulus driven. It's not genuine. You cannot buy it. Right? So, here it is. This is what little old shamatha is for. To balance the mind so that when you're sitting quietly, it's really okay. Even if you're 49 days in the dark, it's really okay. So one monk, rather youngish monk, maybe 30s or so, that I met when I was at that Tsegoba in Tibet, last time I was there, he'd been through it. He'd been through the three-year retreat and been through, of course, therefore, the 49-day dark retreat. And he said, one of two things happen. Either you go insane or you become much more healthy. But you don't kind of, oh, it was okay. Nobody had that experience. It's either horrible or really difficult, less difficulty, and then you come out much saner at the far end. So I think at the contemplative observatory, we should have one hut. Needs special design, but I know a lama who knows exactly how to do it, and he has the transmission. Lama Chityore, Lama Yeshe, from Samye Ling in Scotland. He's got the transmission. From Chukinyimarabaji's father, Toku Ogyen Rinpoche. Special lineage, he's got it. He's done it twice or three times by now. He really knows it. So get your shamatha act together first, though. Get it together. But one hut, so you can make it absolutely light-proof, but good ventilation and plumbing facilities and food and so forth. So you have, you know, everything's normal, but basically you get virtually no stimulation for 49 days. Come out of that, you'll be in good shape. And if you don't, well, you win some, you lose some, what can you say? So, we're now about to venture into the brief discussion of a range of shamatha methods presented by Kamachame Rinpoche. I will give a brief explanation of all of them. We're not going to dwell here a long time. But one method that he teaches that we'll be practicing right now is a practice that Padmasambhava also teaches. It's widely taught. I think it's taught in all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And that is called the Vajra recitation, Dorje Depa, Vajra recitation. Very simple. So it's just simply a minor modification or variation on the mindfulness of breathing that we've already done. So we have now one more bouquet in our little vase of just mindfulness of breathing, right? Full body, abdomen, here at the nostrils. Then you have the Dzogchen approach. You have it with counting or without counting. That already gives us about five. Let's round it off to a nice six. And the six is called the Vajra recitation. Okay, it's very simple. I'm going to front load this. You know what I mean by that. I'm going to talk about it before I do the practice so I can speak very little during the practice so you don't have to multitask, going back to the meditation, listening to me, back to the meditation, flip-flopping. I like to be more continuously in the practice. The practice is very simple. It can be complex, but we're going to keep it simple here, as Kamachame Rinpoche himself does. So Vajra recitation, here it is, it's real simple. And that is, during the course of inhalation, you get one thought. Instead of a whole bunch, you get one. The thought is actually not terribly interesting. You ready? Yeah? Om. That's your thought. Om. Besides that, mum's the word, om. Whole course of one syllable, om. And then come to the end, like coming to the top of a mountain and you're about ready to go down the backside. You come to the top of the mountain, end of inhalation. Okay, you get another one. You ready? Ah, that's lunch. You get breakfast, it's om. And then you come to the top of the mountain, end of inhalation, just before exhalation begins. Ah. Exhalation, you get dinner. Hung. You get three meals, really short meals, per one cycle of breath, and no more. Anything else is overeating. It's junk food for sure. So if you want to get mentally fat, then just be grazing. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, 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 blah. And just going to get fat and soggy in the mind, you know, like a great big jelly belly. So I'm going to give you no diet. You're on the super trim, only 300 calories diet. Okay? Really? No snacking. Three meals per cycle, and you're going to do one cycle is one whole meditation session. So your session is very short. One cycle of breath is an entire cycle. Then you're finished. Right? So om, turn around, ah. Out, hung. Nothing more. Not in Portuguese? Not in Australian? Not in Spanish? Not in whatever you people speak? Only three. Om Ahum. No snacking. Beside that, keep your mouth closed. And then just do that. Okay? Om Ahum. What you're doing is replacing a lot of junk food with three nice, short punctuated syllables. Simplify. Simplify to Om Ahum, Om Ahum. Okay? That's it. Real simple. But that could, I mean, when it's done effectively, it's been taught for a long time, at least 1,000 years. It then really unclutters the mind. Instead of having a whole bunch of junk, you just have these three nice little parcels. Boom, boom, boom. And each cycle being one session, so keep the sessions really short. So I wanted to do it right now, one cycle, just to show you how easy it is. A number of you told me, today one person told me, it's so hard, it's so hard, it's so hard. No, it isn't, it's easy. When you think about it, it's hard. That's hard. Oh, I can't do that for 24 minutes. Oh, I can't. Okay, you ready? We're going to have one session here. One cycle of breath. Inhalation, om. End, ah, hung. Doing out breath, hung. You ready for one cycle of breath? I'm only going to give you one. You don't get two, only one. So don't miss it. You ready? We're going to have about one cycle. Ready? Start right now. Okay, we're finished. Now, who can really say that was hard? And if the first one wasn't hard, why would the second one be hard? The second's no harder than the first one. And the third one is the same as the first one. It's just a repeat. It's kind of like watching the same movie and over and over and over again. So where's the hard part? Right? Completely easy, right? Isn't shamatha the easiest practice you've ever done in your life? Om, ah, hum. Ha! Finished. Success, you get an A. Okay? So let's just do that. Don't think about the future. Doesn't exist anyway. Don't think about the past. It's finished. So there you are. Right there. Om Ahum. That's all there is. Good. Find a comfortable position. Always let your entry into the practice be an inviting one, a pleasant one, an invitation to relax, to let go, to loosen up. As you immediately let your awareness descend into the body, within the body descend to the ground and relax. on the basis of relaxation, still the body, adopt a posture of vigilance. Spine erect, sitting at attention. Then happily release all control over the breath, settle it in its natural rhythm. And allow yourself the freedom. We all have things to do. We all have responsibilities outside of this retreat. But give yourself a break. You don't need to think about them now. It's just a habit. Release the habit. Allow yourself the freedom and the luxury to release all concerns, all hopes and fears, and let your awareness come to rest without grasping, in stillness, in its natural cognizance, its natural clarity. Find that stillness, that unwavering, unflickering candle flame of your own awareness. And from that vantage point, choosing the method that you find most helpful, whether it's full body awareness attending to the rise and fall of the abdomen, or attending to the sensations at the nostrils. From this vantage point, this place of stillness, observe the fluctuations corresponding to the in and out breath. And replace many wandering thoughts with just three per cycle. Om, Ah, Om. And between these thoughts, during the intervals, keep your attention engaged with the sensations of the breath, silently. And let's continue practicing now in silence. Paso. So we finished the section on the physical posture. And so that was done with in quite some detail. What wasn't stated, but what is implied, is that we are, as usual, going from coarse to subtle here. Coarse to subtle is a theme that runs through Buddhism all over the place. And so in terms of our presence here in the world, the coarser level, the more manifest, easily observable aspect of our presence here in the world is physical. You look in any direction, you see that's what you see, the physical. How are you? You feel physical. And so this is the basis. They called it in Shantideva, for example, he says, Dalwe Tendi Yishinole Hla. He says this basis of leisure is more precious, is superior to a wish fulfilling jewel. Remember? First chapter. And so this basis of leisure, what's the basis? It's the body. He's actually saying this body is more precious than a wish fulfilling jewel. This is what makes us human. You know, the body, because our mind is arising, the human mind that we have is clearly, here's complete consensus, neuroscientists, materialists, Buddhists, and so forth, our human mind is arising independent upon human body. So therefore, don't mess up your body. Don't screw up your body, right? Not with poor diet, not with lack of exercise, not with any other type of bad habits. Take care of the body. Very important. As I mentioned, I think, earlier, especially with Gyatri Rinpoche, he always asks, are you taking care of your body? He doesn't even ask me about my practice at this point. Maybe he gave up. I don't know. But he said, are you taking care of your body? Take care of your body. It's important. Take care of your body. You know? So there it is. So this is not just posture. It's diet. It's finding the proper exercise. It's really keeping your body in balance. And on that basis, the mind has a chance of being balanced. There are people who are extremely good physical health and the minds are completely bonkers. So there's no guarantee that just by having a really good body, you'll have a good mind. But at least balancing the body supports the further cultivation, the subtler cultivation of the mind. And that's where we're going now. So here we are on page 72 of our text, the translation. The cultivation of attention, or the cultivation of the mind, on the basis of balancing the body, relaxed, stable, and vivid, or vigilant. We have the cultivation of attention, or simply the cultivation of the mind, and here Kame Chamet writes, possessing those critical factors of the posture, practice cultivating the attention. In the great Indian treatise, The Nine Collections of Concentration, composed by the Indian master Bodhibhadra, it is said that there are two types of shamatha, that which is achieved by looking inwards and that which is achieved by looking outwards. In terms of looking, this reminds me again of Nicholas of Cusa saying, you know, for the path of contemplative insight, the Christian contemplative path, classic. He's not a renegade at all. He was a cardinal, as I mentioned, in the Roman Catholic Church. Incredible being. But he said for the path of contemplation, the contemplative practice in the Christian tradition, he said the way of looking inwards, which they've been practicing for centuries, going back to St. Augustine and the Desert Fathers. But then he added there's also a contemplative path looking outwards. Quite fascinating. Quite fascinating. And that's for more the kind of Christian vipassana practice. But here he's saying also for shamatha, looking inwards, outwards. There's kind of a symmetry there. Because if, after all, inward and outward are not finally dual in any way, you know, if the division is purely nominal, then if it's possible to go inwards, why not outwards? So in terms of looking inwards, there is focusing on the body and focusing on things dependent upon the body. So it's kind of reflexive. It's turning this way. In terms of focusing on the body, there are three types. Focusing on the body in its divine aspect. Well, we've done that. We've already done that a couple of times in the Padmasambhava Guru Yoga. We've done that in Avalokiteshvara. So that's already familiar, right? Pure vision. Pure vision, focusing on the divine aspect, the pure vision. Focusing on the unattractive aspects such as the skeleton. Now, this is actually a shamatha practice. It's bound to be a big hit. Where you're developing shamatha, but you're doing it by looking at it something, I've forgotten the number, but it's something like 35 ingredients of the body. And so you're going in and looking at blood and vessels and marrow and fat and liver and intestines and feces and urine. Oh, this is getting funner and funner. And you can, it's both a shamatha practice and a vipassana practice. When years ago, when I went to Geshe Rabdhen and asked him for, when I left the monastery, because I just wanted to meditate, just didn't want to study anymore, I wanted to meditate. And his holiness said, go for it. And so I said, well, what I want to do is the four applications of mindfulness. So I went to Geshe Rabdhen. And he said, he started teaching me close application of mindfulness to the body. 35 disgusting ingredients, you know? And he finished that and he said, you're not going to practice this, are you? So, I don't want to turn you off or anything, but, you know, this has been done. It can be helpful. That's the second type, focusing. You had pure vision, then impure vision. Because if you really take off the lenses of attachment, and you just see the body nakedly with, you know, you don't let get your hormones involved, you know. I remember Geshe Rabdhen, he was really a monk's monk. And I was with him in Switzerland for years, translating for him. And he had one of those German magazines, you know. German magazines, it could be German magazine about anything, and they're just bound to throw in a great big nude. I don't know what it is about the Germans. You can have a book on cooking, and then, oh, by the way, here's a beautiful lady nude. Oh, okay. And so somebody gave him a magazine. There was this great big spread, this gorgeous, voluptuous German babe, you know, naked as the day she was born, but boy, she was grown up. And Geshe Rabdhen looked at this, and he said, looks like pork. Really does. Look at a shaved pig. You know, get it well shaved. Then look at, you know, an Anglo body, not one of those nicely tanned ones. Those ones that are not cooked, you know, the unbaked variety, you know, like Jenny, like me, like Alan. The unbaked variety, you know, ready for the oven but hasn't gotten in yet. You know, not like, now she's nice. Jose's well baked. That's nice. Well baked. You know, but the unbaked ones, you know. Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. So you can focus pure vision, good cop, impure vision, bad cop. Or you can focus on special signs, such as the kathanka. This is, of course, the staff that Padmasambhava is holding. And Vajragini is holding. So you can focus simply on a symbol. You can focus on a whole body or simply a symbol, a vajra, a katvanka, a bell, what have you. Okay? These are reflexive. So, and I would really strongly encourage you read Gyatro Dhammacca's commentary here. It's very helpful, all the way through this chapter and the whole book. So continuing on with Kamachama Dhammacca, he says, in terms of focusing on things dependent on the body, so that was focusing on the body or body parts or body implements like the katvanka, but then focusing on things dependent upon the body, there are five types. Focusing on the breath, focusing on subtle signs, focusing on a bindu, of course that's a little orb of light, focusing on the attributes of light rays, and focusing on pleasure and joy. So those are interesting. He's going to do this quite quickly, and we will too. So that's that. In terms of looking outwards, there are two types, special and ordinary. In terms of the special, there are two types, focusing on the Buddha's body, focusing on the Buddha's speech. These are ancillary to, or adjunct to, helpers to, entering into shamatha. Okay? I'm not going to elaborate. Gyatro Dhammacca gives a short commentary here. Just leave it at that. I think we have plenty to work with, basically. We have plenty of work with already without going into a lot of scholarly details here. So maintaining the attention on impure things, so that's reflexive. Right, that's looking in the body, but we can looking outwards. Okay, there's focusing on body, there's focusing things dependent on the body. Well, maintaining the attention on impure things such as a pebble and a stick, that kind of practice is discussed by the Venerable Dunden Shap, where he writes, as the basis, focus on a pebble, a stick, an oil lamp, or on spiritual mentors. Okay, so I don't think there's any particular sequence there. Gyatro Dhammacca gives a detailed commentary, really worth reading, and so I encourage you to read that at your leisure. A little minor point here, Padmasambhava, for example, he's one of many teachers who does suggest at the beginning, it's a natural liberation, beginning of his presentation in the shamatha, which is quite extensive. He says, now you may focus on a pebble, a stick, or a flower. Okay, just some natural things that, you know, pretty much wherever you live, you can find it someplace. So easy, and then it's free. Okay, and what he's talking about there, Padmasambhava, and you hear Kamachamara Mbache, what they're talking about is really, quite literally, taking a physical little thing, small, a little flower, a stick, or a pebble, placing it right in front of you. So be sitting on your meditation cushion. Generally, I'm thinking about the Theravada tradition, they say like 45 degree angle down from your eyes, so looking kind of down at an angle, gazing there, and you're literally focusing your eyes on that little thing, that little substance, entity. And of course, focusing your eyes, you're also, most importantly, you're focusing your mental attention. And you just, it's like tying a dog to a post. You tie your attention, fastening it with the rope of mindfulness, which means not forgetfulness, and you just fix your attention. Now, the eyeball's easy, but what you're really training, of course, is not your visual perception or your eyeballs. You're training your mental attention to just stay there, focus. And it's right there. You blink, it's still there when you come back. You don't have to visualize anything. So it's the coarsest. It's the coarsest of the many approaches that he teaches. And if your mind is really coarse, you know, find the shoe that fits. Find the one that's at your level that you can say, okay, I can do that. And if that's where you are, then that's where you are, right? Now, Tsongkhapa and a number of other great scholars from the Indian and Tibetan tradition say, well, okay, but don't think you're going to achieve shamatha by just staring at something with your eyes and with your mind, because that's going to leave you at a coarse level. Yeah. So can it be helpful to subdue coarse ideation, coarse distraction, coarse excitation? Yeah, it can. But will you achieve shamatha by just staring at something? The answer is no. Because it will not, you'll stabilize on a coarse level, very little vividness is going to arise. It doesn't really get better. You're either looking at it, you're not. When you're looking at it, you're looking at it, but you're not going to get better vision. You know, you're not going to go from 2040 to 2020 to 2015 and so forth. It's going to stay the same. And so on a coarse level, that'll be good. But if you're very intent on following a path of shamatha to its culmination, then you need to move on. So it's a good place to start, but don't get stuck there. So, but it's a method, it's been taught, it's been used. Some people find it helpful. And you can focus on the, like an image, you can take an image of, you know, your guru and focus there, same thing, pebble, image of your guru, either one, fine. At a preliminary level. A long commentary here, very helpful by Gyatso Rinpoche. And so, and then we just pick up right on page 76. Counting the breath. So interestingly enough, he cites a tantra here, so he goes directly to Vajrayana, the primary tantra of Manjushri, the Manjushri Mula Tantra, and which states, by resorting to mindfulness of respiration, ideation, that is our rumination, you know about that, compulsive thinking, is calmed, since the mind is completely inflamed, fasten it firmly to one meditative object. Inflamed, you know what that means, agitated, turbulent, and so since it's kind of like a wild horse, wild elephant, what have you, then fasten it, stake it, you know, tie it to a rope and put and attach the rope to a stake in the ground and calm this mind that wants to roam all over the place. So mindfulness of breathing is one method for doing so. And then now he goes to a Mahayana Sutra, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in 10,000 stanzas. And here the Buddha is speaking to his disciple Shariputra. This is classic and very much in accordance with the Pali Canon, the Buddha's discourse on mindfulness of breathing. But here in the Mahayana context, he says, Shariputra, take the analogy of a potter or a potter's apprentice spinning a potter's wheel. If he makes a long revolution, he knows that it's long. If he makes a short revolution, he knows it is short. Shariputra, similarly, a bodhisattva, a great being, mindfully breathes in and mindfully breathes out. If the inhalation is long, he knows the inhalation is long. If the exhalation is long, he knows the exhalation is long. If the inhalation is short, he knows the inhalation is short. If the exhalation is short, he knows the exhalation is short. So very familiar, exactly along the lines of the Buddha's discourses, many discourses in the Pali Canon. Shariputra, thus a bodhisattva, a great being, by dwelling with introspection and with mindfulness, eliminates avarice and disappointment towards the world by means of non-objectification, and he lives observing the body in the body internally. I would say he lives observing the body as the body, I think is better, internally. I'll linger just a little bit on this last sentence. It's very, very rich, full of pregnant with meaning, just bursting with meaning. So he says, a bodhisattva, great being, in other words, he's now couching this clearly within the context of the Mahayana path, the Prajnaparamita. So we know the context. It's not the context of the Pali Canon or some non-Buddhist tradition. It's this context. Dwelling with introspection and mindfulness, okay, this is common to anybody who's practicing shamatha, whatever your tradition, Buddhist, non-Buddhist, religious, non-religious, you've got to be cultivating and refining these two faculties with which you're now, I think, pretty familiar. By dwelling with introspection and with mindfulness, this great being eliminates avarice and disappointment. Avarice is the craving, the attachment, the clinging for hedonic pleasure. That's it, for hedonic pleasure. To elaborate a tiny bit, all the allures, all the attractions of the desire realm. Well, that covers a lot of territory, enormous amount of territory. Everything out there, everything in the world around you, including tangible things like a cell phone or another person or a beautiful home, a car, and so forth, intangible things like being respected and appreciated and loved and admired, having fame and reputation, being praised, having affluence, and so forth and so on. All the things that people scurry around the world for in pursuit of, all the benefits, all the attractions of the desire realm. They're called hedonic. And all the pleasures we get them from them that are stimulus-driven, stimulus-based, are hedonic pleasures. And by dwelling with mindfulness and introspection, this eliminates it. It eliminates it. They fall away. They fall away. And it's just a true statement. I mean, it's an empirically true statement. And it's very simple. And that is, if you've been eating really, how do you say, junk food, that's probably a good example. If you've just kind of been living on junk food, you know, don't eat, you know, you all know what junk food is and all the varieties of it, junk drinks and junk food, and you have all the disadvantages of that, of just living on junk food, supersize me, a movie to really watch for junk food. If you live on that, and then somebody introduces to you to a really healthy diet by a person who really knows how to cook. And who cooks just one really tasty, well-balanced, healthy, nourishing, tasty meal after another, one after another. You look forward to breakfast, you look forward to lunch, but it's so tasty you don't even want to overeat, because that would kind of ruin it, you know, like being with a friend and just talking too much, you know. And so when you start getting that, like, wow, so tasty, but delicious. My body felt so good afterwards. And I digested well, and the body feels light. And then you have lunch and it's the same. Then, before long, you would just lose all interest in junk food. Because you remember, yeah, it tastes good, but then you feel so crappy afterwards. And you feel crappy, and your body looks crappy. It's all the way crappy. That's why it's called junk food, right? And so when you've really had a taste of this is not only healthy and nutritious, but it's really tasty, and you feel so good afterwards. You know, and it feels all the way good. Then it will eliminate all avarice for junk food. And when you, and it's not just are you good at staring at a pebble, or gazing at your breath, but when you really cultivate these qualities of the mind, simple shamatha, relaxation, stillness, clarity, and so doing, developing the five dhyana factors. Your attention becomes single-pointed. That's the direct antidote right there to this avarice, this clinging, craving, attachment to hedonic pleasure. Single-pointed attention, that's it. That's the key right there, you know? Single-pointed attention, a sense of well-being, a sense of bliss, the ability to really to investigate. You've got a clear, sharp mind, ability to analyze more subtle, more detail, more finesse, more rigor. These are the five jhana factors. These are just coming up spontaneously through the practice of shamatha. It's amazing, which means they had to be there already. You're not getting it by some, you know, voodoo from the teacher or some mystical vibration from the text. The seeds are all there, and the shamatha is simply enabling you to unveil these hidden treasures in your own mind stream, because you're clearly not getting them from sensations of the breath or by watching thoughts. They're there all along, but we get so addicted to the junk food of modernity, and it's everywhere. It's music, blaring music when you go to buy some socks. It's blaring music when you go to the fast food joint. It's junk, 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 work, 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 ready for junk, ready for junk. You know, we're just getting inundated with junk all day long. You know, and here's an alternative. So when you get it, when you start really tapping into this wellspring, you say, why on earth does anybody watch that junk on the television? Why does anybody eat that junk food? Why does anybody listen to that junk music and junk reading and junk entertainment and junk work? Why does anybody want that? It's just weird. When they could have this, and this is free. So that's what he's talking about here. You overcome avarice. Because you find something better. You know, if that's all you've got, if you're on a desert island and all you've got is junk food, I wonder what you're going to eat. Of course, you'll take, you know, that which is available. But if you've got an alternative, any sane person is going to go for the nutritious, healthy food. Any sane person is going to go for the five jhana factors. And then find you just have this sense of well-being, whether or not you're doing anything. And if you're doing something, you bring your well-being to the task. You don't hope that the task will deliver. You bring your well-being to your spouse. You don't expect him or her to deliver. You bring your well-being to the work. You don't expect it to deliver. In other words, you don't put your hope in false places. Right. Makes sense. Just common sense, isn't it? So that's avarice. That was my little commentary on avarice. But now, if you overcome avarice, you're going to get a perk. It's a freebie. It's the side effect. It's a side effect of overcoming avarice, and that is you're going to overcome disappointment. Because disappointment comes when you're in pursuit of some hedonic pleasure and it doesn't deliver. You either don't get it or you do get it. Either way, you're going to be disappointed. It's only a matter of time. Right? It's only a matter of time. That's the thing about the hedonic pursuit. It always ends badly. It's over, in which case, oh. Or it's not over and it's, ugh. Either way, it never ends well. And that's it. That's the commentary on the pursuit of hedonic pleasure. It never ends well. So save yourself the trouble. Overcome the avarice. You get the freedom of disappointment free. That one's just a freebie. Towards the world, towards all the mundane pursuits. And by means of non-objectification, I'm going to linger there a little bit. We can understand it in two ways. I mean, many ways, but I'm going to give just two. Non-objectification. What do I want? I want happiness. That's what I want. I want happiness. At least freedom of suffering. But no, you say, what I want. Well, I don't want just not suffering. I want to be happy. I want to be happy. I want to feel good. That's what I want. Okay? What are you going to do about it? That? Maybe that? I encountered that. That made me happy. I think maybe I want more of that. Maybe I can possess it. Maybe I can keep. Maybe I can stay. We objectify. This is a really pleasant place. That's a great restaurant. This is a fantastic car. That is a place that just is wonderful. Disneyland is the happiest place on earth. That's what they said. You know, and if you're 5 years old and not very bright, you might probably believe it. You know. But this objectification that my happiness lies here, there, with this work, that job, this, anything you can point your finger to, that's objectification. It's identifying something that appears to your mind as the source of your happiness. Objectification. You want to be happy? There it is. And it's probably got a price tag. Probably. And so that's objectification. Right? Well, you stop doing that because you've just kind of woken up out of a dadura of delusion, of thinking something that appears to my mind is going to be the source of my happiness. That's complete hallucination. It is literally a type of delusion. And you see, but that's never been true. There are very meaningful relationships, there are possessions that are very useful, there are pleasant places to live, there are types of meaningful work to engage in, there are types of entertainment that are meaningful and helpful, and relaxing and pleasant. It's all true. This is not a sourpuss attitude. It's not the attitude that the world sucks. It doesn't. It breathes in, it breathes out. You know? It's just not being delusional. And so that's non-objectification. Saying, hey, there's only one source of any happiness I've ever experienced in my life or will experience in any future life, within samsara or in nirvana, there's only one source of my happiness ever. Always in the three times, in any possible lifetime, and in enlightenment. And the only source of my happiness has ever been my own mind. And other people, work, places, etc., etc., body and so forth, may or may not catalyze my mind to deliver to me what I want. But the source of my suffering is always internal, and the source of my happiness is always internal, and that's just a fact. It's not a religious fact, it's not a Buddhist fact, it's just, there it is. Everything else consists of cooperative conditions that may or may not catalyze what I want. What I want is happiness. So there it is, that's pretty simple. So that's one non-objectification, and the other one is deeper. And the other type of non-objectification in the context of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra is Dembaradzimba, grasping to true existence, the reification, the non-objection, that it's really out there, exactly like in a non-lucid dream. That person is really over there, that is really over there, I'm really over here. The non-objectification, the non-subjectification, that I'm really over here, the non-dualistic grasping. Well, now we're going deep. The other one, if you release the objectification of the true sources of happiness, that's going to give you a lot of peace, serenity, and happiness within samsara. If you tap into a true source, while giving up all attachment to the non-true sources. But if you're looking for transcendent well-being, the deepest form of eudaimonia, then that's to be found through non-objectification. And again, I'll correct myself. Several days ago, I said that this text, Jemba Jidel, I thank you, T.L., for this example, by the way, a friend of mine, a very good monk. He corrected me on this. He's a very good Sakya monk. And he said, this text, Jemba Jido, Parting from Four Attachments, it's not from Sakya Pandita, one of the great ones, but from the patriarch, Sachin Kunga Nyingbo, the first of the great, the five of the great Sakya lineage. And he received it from Manjushri. So it's just parting from four, parting attachments, and Katasa. Zimbajun the Tawa met. That's the fourth one. Zimbajun the Tawa met. If grasping is present, if grasping arouses, you don't have the view. There's no view. You don't have the Shravaka view, you don't have the Bodhisattva view, you don't have the Vajrayana view, you don't have Madhyamaka view, you don't have Dzogchen and Mahamudra, you don't have the view if you're still grasping. If you're grasping, oh, that person will make me happy, that thing, that's grasping, forget about it. You're not even a Dharma practitioner. If you're still grasping, reifying anything, you don't have the view of emptiness. If you're still grasping onto yourself, I am a sentient being, well, now you don't have the view of Dzogchen or Mahamudra. So Dzogchen, the grasping. So that's from Manjushri by way of Sachin Kunga Nyingbo. So that was a commentary on one sentence. By dwelling with introspection and with mindfulness, this eliminates avarice and disappointment towards the world by means of non-objectification. And he lives, this great being, this bodhisattva, lives observing the body as the body internally. That is, the awareness is reflexive. It's attending to the body as a body, which is a really good idea, because a body is not a human being. This is the screaming falsehood of materialism. I mean, it's screaming like an agony falsehood of materialism. That you are a body. Oh, no non-tour statement has ever been made. It's not only false, but catastrophically false. People are not bodies. That's why we say we have a body. Not I am a body, have a body. We have a mind. And so you observe the body as a body, you don't observe the body as a human being. It's so profoundly and tragically, I think that's the best term. I don't want to go into a big rant and rave and polemic, but it's tragic. And it's so obvious. We know this. Materialists know this. They forget what they know. Take a man who looks at a woman and just sees a body. What do we call that? A slob. Right? A man looks at a woman and just sees a body. And that's all he sees, a body. You're an asshole. I'm sorry, you're a slob. You're, come on, get a life. There's more to that than that. She's not just a body, she's a human being. What are you? What's wrong with you? It's a human being you're looking at there. And you're just seeing boobs and tits and whatever they have. Hell, you know, come on. This is wrong. It's wrong in every sense of the term, it's wrong. And of course, the same. If a woman looks at a man just as a body, what's wrong with you? It's dehumanizing. It's tragic. And of course, it's going to turn out badly because these bodies never get more and more beautiful as they get older. They just get, well, look at me, you know, just imagine the next 20 years. Grayer, wrinklier, saggier, more ugly, 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 until finally dead. Really? So let's not look at the body as a human being. Just look at the body as a body. That's what it is. It's a body. There it is. So in other words, it's sanity. That's all this is. This is not hoity-toity being spiritual. This is kind of like just being sane. And the materialists are being insane by looking at a person and seeing only a body, seeing a body and thinking that's a person. That's just nuts. And they don't believe it. That's the thing that's really, the hypocrisy of it is searing. Because, you know, a good hardcore materialist looking at his child, you really think he looks at his child and says, my child is just a body. Do you really think any of them think that? Bullshit. No, I'm sorry, bulls, I didn't mean to denigrate you. So there it is, that my big commentary on this one little line. A sutra states when the breath is going out, he correctly knows the breath is going out. When the breath is going in, he correctly knows the breath is going in. And just by the way, the Sanskrit and Tibetan are gender neutral. There's not he, it doesn't have a male bias. We just don't have a gender neutral third person singular word in English. And to keep on saying he-she, 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 it just gets clunky, so I say he. So, here is the meaning. Without distraction, direct mindfulness to the going and coming of the air. And when the air moves out, do not be distracted from that. When it comes back in, do not be distracted from that. Thus, the basis of mindfulness is the two movements of the pranayama of the air. While so doing, do not forsake the guard of mindfulness. The Sutra of the Ten Wheels of Kshitigarbha, again a Mahayana Sutra, states, how do you correctly note with the power of mindfulness the in and out movement of the breath? You count them correctly. So we see this is not just a Theravada or Shravayana practice. It's Mahayana and it's Vajrayana, all three. And it's couched within the perfection of wisdom. So that's mindfulness of breathing. And this point made by the Buddha in the Pali Canon that for those personality types who are especially prone to a lot of compulsive ideation, rumination and so forth, the recommended method, just like a doctor prescribing a medicine for people with a certain type of illness, the recommended shamatha practice is mindfulness of breathing. And that includes almost everybody in the modern world. So there we have counting the breath. And then we have this three-syllable vajra recitation. We've already done it, so now we just get a bit of conceptual framework for it. The Nyingma teachings call the manifestation of vairochana state. With the simultaneous arising of the vital energy and the mind, the aspect of the om with the inhalation, ah with the pause, and hung with the exhalation transforms the obscurations of the body, speech, and mind, and the entire three realms into the three vajras. The vajras of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind are achieved, and great inborn joy arises. So om, ah, hum, body, speech, and mind. This is the meaning. When the breath moves inside the nostrils, coming inside, recall the sound of om. When it pauses slightly inside, recall ah. When it goes outside, recall hum. The shape of the syllables and their colors, such as white, do not need to be considered. So he's keeping it nice and simple here. There are more elaborate, complicated ways of doing it. He kept it simple. Do this some 50 times without interruption by other thoughts. Then increase to 500 and so on. Be at ease. Oh, then you know he's a Mahamudra teacher. If you're galupa, you say, try hard. Bear down. Ten. At ease, soldier. You know how galupas go, at ease? That's at ease. You should see them when they're uptight. Give it a rest, galupas. You know, get cozy with the nyamapas. Nyamapas, get your act together. Follow these galupas much more. They, you know, they really know discipline. Oh, yeah. Let's stop there. So, now that I've slandered all of the schools of Tibetan Buddhism, I'll first go to the Galupa hell, and then the Sakyapa hell, and the Nyingma hell, get the grand tour of all the hells. So, shame on me. Yeah. Unrepentant. So, especially for people who have your interviews with Glenn, and especially if I've not heard from you, I'd love any questions or comments, observations, insights, experiences, or anything else. Anything coming up? Yes, please. Microphone is coming. Yeah, thank you.
Hello, I'm Yvette.
Odette?
Yvette.
Yvette, thank you. Did you say Kangaroo Island or?
North Stradbroke.
North Stradbroke. And where is it?
It's about an hour from central Brisbane.
Oh, a lovely area then. Perfect. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And what's there? There's a retreat center?
There will be.
There will be. Whoa, wow. Okay.
It would be good, yeah.
Yes, oh, it's a lovely area. Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it's lovely. I've been to Brisbane. It's a lovely city. So, everybody listening podcast, run to Brisbane. There's going to be a retreat center there soon.
Yeah, we'll vision it. I'm not the most articulate person, so I prepared a question.
Good, fine. Writing. That's fine.
Okay, so I was first taught by the Dharma in a traditional way, and I identified with Carl Jung's belief that any religion worthwhile was sort of driven in symbolism.
Yes, indeed. Sure. So is materialism.
That symbols work by the nature of being a symbol, and it suited me as I visualized easily.
Yeah.
So visualizing meditation, I thought that was really good for me at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And then after many years and many teachers, I've become more hardened to the Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's crusty. Yep.
And I tend to do practice out of respect to my teachers.
Yeah.
And I could spend like an hour just cleaning the room and setting up the altar and you know, that sort of thing, and then just not doing practice at all.
Yeah, but at least the altar is well prepared for somebody else. Yeah.
And then I sort of really yearn for something really simple like Shantaya, something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
So how does one get over the guilt of not following the precious teacher's instructions, practices, and motivation, but not always feel this guilt of, you know,
following
every single one of these practices.
Right. Very good question. So the question is from Yvette. Having received many teachings, I think, over a number of years from, I'm sure, very fine teachers, because there are quite a number of fine teachers out and about, and many have passed away by now. One can feel, I'm going to be paraphrasing a little bit, but one can feel a little bit inundated with the myriad of all the teachings and practices and symbols, this, symbols, that, and kind of just get a little bit crusty, a little bit, how do you say, yeah. What was the word you used? You had a nicer one. I said crusty, but you had a better one.
Hardened.
Hardened, yeah, a bit hardened, yeah, a bit hardened. Yeah, like an old shoe.
Just sort of going through the motions.
I do understand, sure. I think, but, and I want to really try to paraphrase your question because you're absolutely not alone, right? And so then a longing arises, well, on the outside, kind of doing the outer things, preparing the altar and going through the various gestures. Nice, that's not a pejorative term, the gestures. Then kind of feeling, well, I'm not really following these many, many teachings that I received. Maybe that's kind of disrespectful. Now I feel guilty. But I'm looking for something more simple, something more to the point, something less elaborated, and what to do there. And what to do with the guilt, a feeling that somehow I'm showing disrespect for these teachers who clearly were very kind in offering their teachings to the best of their ability. I have total confidence in that, you know, wherever they're coming from. These, you know, I think they're really offering their very best. So I'm very glad you asked that. It came up again in one of my private meetings with someone today. I think it's a very important point, and it's worth several minutes. I mean, it's worth a lot, but to cut to the chase. We're really in the infancy. I think we really need to take a big view, the wide-angle lens, zoom back on an arc of 2,500 years of Buddhism, spending from the 8th century up until the 13th, 500 years, making its way to Tibet, and then being clobbered, being smashed, you know, pretty much obliterated, and then being reintroduced, and then, you know, about 500 years for it really to get its sea legs, to really feel like, okay, it's home now, that we're not practicing Indian Buddhism, we're practicing Tibetan Buddhism. By the time you get to the 12th, the 13th century, people like, you know, Lonchenpa, Milarepa's been there, Marpa's been there, Atisha's been there, they're kind of like, hey, I think we're home now, you know? And we can look from around that time, something, and it's more or less 12th, 13th, 14th century, it's home. They've translated, it's now in their own language, it's home, you know? They don't really feel they're doing some foreign import anymore. The same thing happened in China, it took also a good deal of time, happened in Japan, took a long time, Mongolia, that took centuries, even Southeast Asia, that took, you know, quite some time. We've been doing this for 40 years, 50 years. 1960 or so, so maybe 65 years, something like that, 55, 60 years. We're really, it's in the infancy, and it's not just the West, of course, it's Buddha Dharma going globally. It's all very recent. And so, if we focus just for the time being, and I think we may as well, on Tibetan Buddhism, you know, this has been happening in multiple areas, Chan and Zen and Theravada, if we just focus on Tibetan, because you mentioned the altars and all of that, I know exactly where all that's coming from. I know when I went to Dharamsala in 1971, I had this very strong feeling that apart from a little bit of modification directly from His Holiness Dalai Lama, and he did do that from the very beginning, the opening of the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, where I first started receiving instruction, he did some modification, and it was brilliant. It was so spot on. And he was only 35 years old at the time, 36, still very young, but he already knew you can't teach these Westerners just as if they were Tibetan. So he modified it somewhat in a wonderful, very highly intelligent, insightful way. But apart from that, I'd have to say really, well, the teachings we received were as if we were Tibetans. You know, really. I mean, because we were pretty much the first Westerners these lamas had ever taught. You know, there were hardly any translators back then. They were really, the translators, three or four lamas, 300 or 400. You know, so the translators were in really high demand, and they were pretty young, you know. So it's difficult because we're so wildly not Tibetan. You know, we're really not Tibetan. And that's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just, you know, we're not Tibetan, you know, in so many very important ways. And so so just a tiny bit of background. But I had the good fortune, I had many, many good fortunes during the first 4 years that I was just went for total immersion in Tibetan culture. Speaking, reading, dreaming, everything. Total immersion in the cultures, becoming a monk and into the monastery and so forth. One of the boons of that time was the fact that I lived for more than a year with the Dalai Lama's personal physician, became fluent quite quickly in Tibetan, and then I served for quite a long time as his personal interpreter. I was his primary interpreter. Because he too, when he's diagnosing, when he's treating Western, anybody who's not Tibetan, he could speak Hindi, so Indians he could take care of, but all the rest, Europeans, Australians, Americans, he needed, well, I was it. He gave me the opportunity. I lived in his home where nobody spoke English. So of course I'm going to do that. But why I'm getting to this, why I'm alluding to this, was there was a very, very powerful analogy that I think everybody listening should bear in mind. I think it's really important. And it's nothing fresh for me, otherwise it couldn't be that important. But this is something deeper than that. And that is, here's how it works. If you're coming with maybe even complex illnesses, not just a cold or hiccups, but you have something complex, you know, you're seriously ill, and you come to a Tibetan doctor, and he was quite possibly the world's best. He was the Dalai Lama's personal physician. His Holiness can have anybody he likes, you know, it's a great position of great honor. Here's how it works. You come to the doctor, you bring a urine sample, which he will analyze in a very sophisticated way, and you come in there, hopefully quite fairly rested. You have not just been having a big argument or running a marathon. So you're coming in, your body is relatively in a state of balance, and then he takes the pulse. He checks the urine. He'll ask you some questions. He'll observe you. And he was truly superb. I mean, what he could pick up with pulse, with the urine, observing you, and then a bit of questioning was simply stunning. I mean, he was so good. That's just the diagnosis. And then the treatment was standardly would be you get some herbal compounds. Sometimes they'll have 30, 40, 80, 100 ingredients in one little pill that looks like a goat dropping, but it's much more complex. You'll get one in the morning, maybe take one or two in the morning before breakfast, one or two in the afternoon after lunch, one or two in the evening after dinner before bread. That's it. So he gives them to you. All right. But you come back a week later. If you're living there, you come back a week later. This is your follow-up. And then you bring your urine again, he checks the pulse again, but he will ask you, this is a strong model, that's why I'm lingering on this, which is answering your question, but not quite explicitly yet. He'll ask you, when you took the medication, how did it work? After lunch, how did you feel? How are you sleeping? What were the shifts in your body that took place over the last week as a result of taking these medications? And did you follow the dietary restrictions I gave you? Because he always does. If you didn't follow the dietary restrictions, why the hell are you wasting my time? He didn't quite say it that way, but that's what he meant. Why are you wasting my time? Because I told you, you have to follow these dietary restrictions. You cannot eat food that is going to aggravate the imbalances that are in your body. You must stop doing that. If you're doing things physically that are harmful to your health, you must stop that. If and only if you do that, will these medications be helpful? So we're going from gross to subtle. Okay. Did you do that? Did you follow the behavioral? If I gave you behavioral advice, if I gave you dietary advice, did you follow it? You did? Good. Now, and you took the medication every single day? You did that also? Okay, good. Now, how did it turn out? Now, this is the Dalai Lama's physician, right? He's only one step away from the Dalai Lama. So one could approach him, if one's really a numbskull, a silly person, foolish person, you could say, well, you're the supreme doctor. It turned out well because it had to, because you're the supreme doctor. Whatever you said was perfect. And it was perfect. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Then you're really stupid because he asked you a really important question. Did it work or did it not work? Was it helpful? Was it not helpful? If it was helpful, how so? If there were disadvantages, there were side effects, what were they? You have to be attending, you have to report back, and the doctor is wide open. He wants to hear. This is not a formalism, this is not a ritual. And then you tell him, and you tell him, including what you might think is bad news, but is simply reality, actually this gave rise to more indigestion in the afternoon. I'm not sure that afternoon medication was really good, because I felt really poorly afterwards. And I find I'm really having a hard time sleeping. I'm wondering about the evening med, but the morning is really good. He'll listen to you. And then he'll tell you one of two things. He said, I know you. This is actually that you're feeling worse. That's good. That was expected. That this is good. This means the medicine is working, so don't worry about it. Take the same medicate. This will pass, but for the time being, you're going to feel worse, and that's okay, because this needs to be processed. On other occasions, oh, you're feeling bad there? Oh, in case that, I'm going to change your medicine. Yeah, that wasn't quite spot. That's not quite. Or it's time to maintain the medicine now. Or you're overall getting better? Good, now I can give you a stronger medicine. Even though the last ones were good, I'm going to give you a stronger medicine now. If I gave it to you earlier, your body couldn't take it. But now it can. And I'm going to replace the morning medicine with this one. The last one's fine, but this one will now take you further to this path to recovery. You see what's happening here? Is it's going back and forth. It's week after week. If you have a complex chronic array of imbalances in the body, this can go on for weeks and weeks and weeks, right? But it always entails dialogue. And you have to tell if it's not working, or you think it's not working, and you have to be observant, you have to report. And it's always done with respect. This person here to heal you, that's the only person, he doesn't even charge you. He doesn't even charge you the consultation. The consultation is free. All you're paying for is the medication. And what you're paying for is a price that Tibetan refugees can pay, which means it's a pittance. It's pittance, you know. But now that's the model. The Buddha is the great physician. That's one of the epithets of the Buddha. He's the great physician. He has only one job. There's only one reason he was teaching. Only one reason, and that was to help alleviate the suffering of the world. There was no other reason for him to get off his cushion in Bodh Gaya. He's the great physician. That means the whole lineage of all the teachers ever since then. If you're a Dharma teacher, you have only one job. Only one. You are here to heal people of their mental afflictions, of their behavior that flows from mental afflictions, to heal them from the suffering and the cause of suffering. Your job description could not be simpler. But whether you're the Dalai Lama or you're me, I'm basically a village Lama, you know, lowest level, wherever you are. But it doesn't matter whether you're Gaudiya, you're Dzogchen Lingpa, you're His Holiness, or Dikun Kinzerin, but you're whatever. They're all physicians. And it's Lama Zubar Rinpoche, it's Geshe Rabdin, whoever it is, they're all physicians. And this means you receive the instruction, you practice it, and report back, for heaven's sakes. Don't be a dummy and say, oh, the Lama's omniscient, the Lama's perfect, whatever he said, absolutely, forever, immutably, carved in granite, this was the perfect instruction for me, and if I'm not feeling good, well, that's my problem. I'm sure it's my fault. That's just stupid. You know? So I think we often miss this, because we're still in diapers. We're still in the infancy period. That the guru is a Kalyanamitra, spiritual friend. I mean, that the Buddha is a Kalyanamitra. This is not just for low-level ones like me. Oh, I'm just a Dharma friend. I'm a Dharma friend. That's fine. The Buddha is a Dharma friend. The Buddha is a Kalyanamitra. So is Shariputra. So is Shantideva. So is Nagarjuna. So is Padmasambhava. He's a spiritual friend. That means they've got a job to do, and that is to help us in our practice. This means they not only talk, but they listen. And so I think we often don't do this. That we listen, the Lama does the mo, the Lama gives his instruction, and we kind of think, oh, it's got to be infallible, it's got to be perfect, I mustn't talk back, because what do I know? I'm just a schmuck, I'm just an ordinary sentient being. We're missing the whole point. It'd be like going to the doctor and saying, oh, I don't know what I experienced, or if I did, it doesn't matter, because what am I? I'm just a sentient being, I don't know anything, just tell me what's the next medication. You sound like an imbecile. If you go to a Tibetan doctor, you sound like an imbecile. What do you have? Brain damage. I just ask you, how did it work? Did you follow the diet? Did you do this? What was the benefit? What are you, an imbecile here? What are you, a baby? This is supposed to be an adult relationship here. You're taking responsibility for your health, and I'm here to help you. Not to have you sacrifice all sense of responsibility and be a dummy, you know? And I think sometimes we treat our lamas with no respect, by not having the courage and the respect to tell them what's really going on and what our heart aspiration really is. So if they tell us to do something we have no interest whatsoever in doing, then just tell them that with respect. I'm really not drawn to that practice at all. Should I do it anyway? But keep the dialogue going. This is absolutely not an expression of disrespect. Any more than if you tell the doctor, I took that after medication and I felt nauseous afterwards. What's that, disrespect? It's just being truthful so that the doctor can do his job and you can do your job. And you can both be responsible in this friendship, which is all about you. It's not about the doctor. He doesn't need this. He's giving himself medication. He's taken care of, right? The whole relationship is for the patient. That's it. And likewise, in a guru-disciple relationship, it's all about the disciple. The guru should be just fine with having no disciples. I mean, really fine, right? So I think we've really been emphasizing this a lot more, of approaching the guru with responsibility, with respect, and the respect is expressed in being totally honest, candid, straightforward, and expressing our heart's desire. So I learned this, oh, time is out, but I really first encountered this vividly when I went back to Dharamsala, feeling I was the luckiest person on the planet. Because His Holiness had encouraged me to come back, to go into my first long retreat under His guidance. I thought, oh, I must be the most fortunate person on the planet. You know? And I still feel I kind of was, you know. I mean, he is who he is. He's the Mahasattva. He gave me a practice. I tried doing it at one point. I'll tell you, we'll just be a tiny bit late for lunch. But he gave me a practice. I won't tell the whole prank, but I'll just tell one part of it. He said, okay, so I got into it, 2 or 3 weeks went by, I went down for my second or third consultation, and he said, well, okay, very good, now try it this way. And he upped the ante, he made it more challenging, more difficult, right? More difficult. He told me, okay, do this. This is His Holiness, Avalokiteshvara speaking. Alan, do this. Okay. 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 And so I don't know how, it was something like 2 or 3 weeks, because he has a lot of things to do besides attend to me, but, you know, so I was up there in my little hut up on the top of the mountain, on the side of the mountain. I couldn't do it. I tried and I tried and I tried, and I was just like bending metal. It was just, I couldn't do it. I tried every way. I tried hard, I tried soft, I tried smart, I tried dumb, I tried any way, and I could not do it. He just gave me something I couldn't do. And he's Avalokiteshvara. How could he do that? It must be I'm a total loser, because he Avalokiteshvara gave me this practice and I couldn't do it. And that means I'm a total loser. But I still can't do it. So I went down and I told him, I tried to do what you said. I couldn't. And he said, okay, do it the old way then. Oh. That was an eye-opener for me. It was really okay. Well, then do it the old way. That's okay, do it that way. Okay? Clear. This is important.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Wonderful question. I hope somebody would ask something like that. So now I've answered. This is where Dharma grows. This is where we grow. This is where the lamas grow, because they want to be more and more effective for us, the Tibetan lamas. The Chinese teachers, the Theravada teachers, the Thai teachers, they want to be more. Why else would they teach? Really, because they don't have a job. They're teaching to be helpful. They want to be more helpful. Otherwise, why would they be teaching? I think most of them have very good motivation. But how could they be more and more helpful if we're not giving them more and more honest, insightful, clear and accurate reports on how the practice is going? How can we help them help us more effectively? How can we all work together that the Dhamma really flourishes, you know. And if it's not flourishing in our hearts and minds, it's not flourishing anywhere. So that's it. Okay. Good night.